Good afternoon. This is Sharon Lockhart in the studio with Ember Urbach, a new volunteer on Every Woman, Donna Wolf at The Engineer, and joining us in the show today. And our guest today is Jackie Gafford, who has written The Life and Times of Barbara Jordan, and will be performing that at the Community Christian Church on October 12th. And first, I think we've got a wee bit of news. Today is Fun Drive, and also really something exciting is that 3:30 we're going to be broadcasting live from UMKC. Cornell West will be speaking there, and KKFI is broadcasting that at 3:30. So in the meantime, Ember, you have some news briefs to give us, and you said not much of it was good.
Yeah, unfortunately. This past Sunday, as we all have probably heard by now, heavily armed gunmen opened fire on the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival in Las Vegas, Nevada, killing at least 39 people and injuring more than 500. And following this mass shooting, debates have reemerged, pinning the Second Amendment against the safety and well-being of the public. And central to this debate right now is the use and sale of bump stocks. Bump stocks are devices that convert semi-automatic firearms, which are legal to own and purchase, into weapons that fire at nearly the rate of automatic weapons. And despite the concerns of the sales of these, gun rights advocates and proponents of the Second Amendment are worried that restricting gun ownership may leave Americans without the ability to protect themselves. Though studies by the National Bureau of Economic Research have shown that states with looser gun laws have higher rates of non-lethal crime and an insignificant change in the rate of homicide.
And I understand Yoder, I can't remember now, he sort of came out and said something that was, I think, a positive about gun control, but yet he was also a sponsor of the silencer bill. It's so conflicting.
It is, and the NRA came out and said that they were open to the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms looking into the bump stock issue, but I don't really know what that means, looking into something versus...
means nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
It is the NRA.
Yeah.
In more bad news, on Friday, the Trump administration announced an action to allow employers to deny insurance coverage for birth control based on their own religious or moral convictions. So employers can now refuse to cover this care for employees, despite the fact that it is protected preventive services under the Affordable Care Act. And while President Trump has said before that avoiding STDs while dating models was his own personal Vietnam, his administration seems to have little regard for reproductive health. So, yeah, there's just kind of silence faces around here because it's a little ridiculous. More than 55 million women have access to birth control without a copay because of the contraceptive coverage mandate. But under new regulation, hundreds of thousands of women could lose those benefits. And while this seems to be a landmark day for religious liberty, according to Speaker Paul Ryan, it's leaving many women across the United States asking at what cost.
Wait a minute. What religious liberty? Whose religious liberty?
Right. I know.
That's incredible. Incredible.
Absolutely.
And these people, it just boggles your mind to listen to them and their logic or illogic. Let's see. Oh, and then also it seems that anything that has Obama's name on it, Trump is out to defy.
Right.
Like the Iran
nuclear deal.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, which is surely in heaven's name. He's going against his own counsel on that.
Right,
surely,
common sense. Yeah,
and common sense. And surely in heaven's name, the Senate won't allow that. But anyway, do we have anything else unpleasant to report today?
I had just one other thing, which is the directive by Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who ordered the Justice Department to follow, you know, through their court appearances and cases like that, that transgender people are not protected by the Civil Rights Act of 1964. He's kind of splitting hairs here. That it talks about sex in the act, which refers to biologically male or female, according to Jeff Sessions, and not gender. So for some reason, he's finally kind of taking time to look into the difference between sex and gender, but only on the basis that it can be used to further discriminate. So that's kind of the chunk of news I have for today.
Wow. Well, thank you for compiling that. Yeah. And our guest today, Jacqueline Gafford, is well-known in the theater community in Kansas City. You've just about performed in every venue, as far as I could tell from your biography.
Yeah, you stay around long enough, and eventually you do.
And you have your own company.
Yes, In Play Theater Company. We perform out of the Just Off Broadway Theater.
Okay. And you were performing there, and some women from the League of Women Voters happened to see you and asked you if you would do a fundraiser for them that's coming up this October 12th at the Community Christian Church. And I believe the time is 7 p.m.
Yes.
And tickets information is available at...
It's at the League of Women Voters website, which is lwvkc.org.
And the proceeds will support their effort to make sure voter ID, that you don't get shut out of the vote.
Right. It's going to go to help people to get the correct documents for the voter ID law, and also to support the initiative against the voter ID.
Great. And so tell us, what prompted you to write this play about the life and times of Barbara Jordan? And maybe tell our listeners who Barbara Jordan is.
Oh, my goodness.
If they don't know.
The play is quite... It's not a brand new play, and I have to invoke the name of Jean Mackey, who is the artistic director at Theater for Young America. Initially, I'm going to say it was almost 20 years ago that that he and I collaborated and we created a script for children that actually had at least three characters in it. And later on, went in and adapted the script. I did a lot more research on it. I updated it, made it much more adult, and I changed it into a one-woman show. But I do have to thank Jean Mackey for the incentive to do that with this script.
Great. And who is he affiliated with?
Theater for Young America.
Okay, good. Well, and of course, this is set, well... She came to the forefront in 1967.
She was initially elected to the Texas Senate in 1967. That was the first time that they had really had a woman elected to the legislature in the state of Texas. She stayed there for 6 years. She was there from 67 until 73, at which time she was then elected to the Congress. And at that point, it became even more rarefied. She was the first black person, let alone woman, to be elected to the Congress to represent the state of Texas in Washington, D.C.
So women truly are leaders.
Definitely. And she was a leader at the time. It's really difficult to understand that she was only on the political scene for 12 years. So she was elected in Texas, in the Texas Senate. She was there for 6 years. And then she was elected to the United States Congress, and she was there for 6 years, from basically 73 to 79.
And then she retired?
Initially people thought that she simply retired. Since her death in 96, it came out that she was actually diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And being the person that she was, she did not feel that it was fair for her to stay in that seat. She was so popular, she could have been reelected every year with a minimal amount of effort. But she felt that since she was not able to put forth the effort that she was used to putting forth for that seat for her constituents, that it was best for her to step down.
So that didn't come out then until her death.
No, and there was a lot of speculation. And there was a lot of disappointment also, because she was on a fast track. Had she not, become ill, she could have been a Secretary of State. She was on the list of Jimmy Carter's vice presidential choices, and she probably would have been the first woman to be appointed to the Supreme Court. But we will never know. Yeah. But she was on that track.
Now, she, there was one in particular speech, or maybe more than one, but something that she was particularly noted for.
She was noted for the speech that she made concerning the impeachment of Richard Nixon. And the reason she is known for that is she was a junior member of that judicial committee. And she had to wait a long time to get an opportunity to speak because, of course, the senior members got to speak first. And she, by the time she got a chance to speak, it was the middle of the night. But because her speech was so compelling, it was played over and over and over again on the three, at the time, national news cycles. And a lot of people got an opportunity to hear her. She laid out everything that the Constitution said and that Richard Nixon had been accused of and what they felt they could prove. And that explanation basically changed the tide with the American people, because when it was laid out like that and people said, oh my goodness, he knew about this, because the main thing was, as people would say, what he knew and when did he know it? And you find out that he knew everything from the very beginning, and thus he laid out this plan of cover up for everything that was going on, the break-in at the Democratic National Convention office, the break-in of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. He knew about all of it, and he was just trying his best to cover it up. I mean, he was like an octopus moving everything around.
Very mindful something that's going on now.
Yeah, right. He used the CIA. He used the FBI. He made all kinds of threats. He pulled senators in. He pulled congressmen in. He pulled other staff members in. He threatened people. And fortunately for us, unfortunately for him, it was all on tape.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the KKFI time of the year, one of the times of the year, that we come out to the listeners and ask for your support for the kind of programming that KKFI brings you. And so right now I'm going to ask you, if you're out there listening, to please take time to make a phone call to 888-931-0901. That's 888-931-0901 with your pledge to KKFI and the kind of programming that we bring to you, which is, to me, it just packs a wallop. On Saturday afternoon, I think our programming is stellar because it's so much local community, local issues, local people, and you just don't have a voice like this out there available anyplace else but on KKFI to hear Jackie Gafford talk about her play and about Barbara Jordan. So right now we have a champion, I think they're called, someone who will match your pledge. Kathy Peters has volunteered to match for the next 7 minutes. We've got to set the timer. Pledge up to $200 pledges. So if you can call in a $10 pledge, a $20 pledge, your pledge will be matched up to a $200 total. So please call right now, 888-931-0901, and let us know that you appreciate the volunteers that come in here day in, day out, 24/7, to bring you programming, local, national, syndicated, Amy Goodman, all the talk shows that are on, Jaws of Justice, local programming, that really is really good programming, in my opinion, of course, but then that's just my opinion, and I'm hoping it's your opinion too. Call us right now, 888-931-0901, and help us get that $200 match that Kathy Peters has offered. Thank you so much. And Jackie, could you give maybe a bit of your play speech, maybe something from the play? Am I catching you off guard here?
Well,
I should have asked you beforehand that I was going to throw this at you to be Barbara Jordan.
Well, I'll just say this. The play, the premise of the play, it follows Barbara Jordan's life, and towards the end, she was a professor of law at the University of Texas, and the play is about the first day of class as she greets her class and she lets them know what is going to be expected of them. I can give you a little bit of the intro to good. The play.
Thank you.
Good morning, class. I hear the sound of 10 bells tolling. That means it is time for class to begin. How are you this morning? My name is Barbara Jordan. You may call me Congresswoman Jordan, Professor Jordan, or Miss Jordan. I'm really not particular. Whatever is easiest for you to get your mouth around. How are you this morning? Are you sure you're in the right class? Some of you look a little young, and some of you look a little old. Well, never mind. This is political values and ethics, graduate level. And I am very happy to have all of you in my class.
Wow, political values and ethics. We could use a bit of that around. We could just spread that around in a lot of places I can think of.
I agree totally.
Yeah.
You know, back in the day, I was so inspired by Barbara Jordan. I wrote to Barbara Jordan, and she responded to me.
Wow.
And I've got to find that. Now it's an artifact somewhere.
Yes, it is.
It is.
Yes.
And she was. She took me seriously. She was encouraging and supportive. And it was one of the biggest thrills I've ever had to receive that kind of, you know, attention from someone whom I thought was just immense and great.
I am not surprised at that in the least. Barbara Jordan... People think that everything was just handed to her, but Barbara Jordan had to work very hard to get where she was. She came from a lower middle class family. Her mother was a piano teacher or a musician. Her father was a minister. And she had to work very hard just to get to college. She was lucky enough to get into Texas Southern, and then she was lucky enough to become part of a debate team at Texas Southern, which received national recognition. And because of that, she applied to Georgetown University, and she was lucky enough to get into Georgetown, but that's where luck ran out, because in the 50s, which is when she went to school there, there was such a disparage between the black university system and, for lack of a better word, the white university system. And she had to, as my father would say, she had to run three races. One to get there, one to catch up, and one to keep up. And the first semester, she very nearly had a nervous breakdown trying to figure out all of the things that she needed to know, and then to realize that the students that she was sitting next to, they were the children of senators and congressmen and Supreme Court justices and ambassadors, and these young people had traveled the world, and they thought nothing of it. Mm-hmm. And here she was, this little girl from Fifth Ward in Houston, who couldn't even go home over the Christmas holidays because she couldn't afford it. And after that first semester in law school, she then realized, I can't digest this by myself. And all of the other black students who were in that class, and one of the people that was in that class was Maynard Jackson, who became mayor of Atlanta. And those students realized they had to band together. Mm-hmm. And there were, you know, black students and some other foreign students who simply were not approached by the other students to be part of a study group. Anybody who's been to law school knows that you cannot digest all of that information by yourself. You have to have a sounding board. You have to be able to discuss the issues that those instructors give you. And once those students band together and started digesting this material together, she found it much easier to get through. And at that point, she realized, okay, I can do this. I won't be at the top of the class like I've always been in the past, but I'm not going to be at the bottom either. Mm-hmm. And that's basically how they were able to survive Georgetown.
Wow, that's quite fascinating, things you don't really think about. It goes back to how amazing it is that she was the first black person elected.
Since Reconstruction, yes, mm-hmm. since probably the 1860s to the legislature in Texas.
Wow. That's amazing.
And to be a black woman in Texas who's gone through law school, who's dealt with systemic barriers and the barriers just inherent in being a politician and going to law school and completing all those tasks, and her being there and standing in that state office was an act of revolution in itself.
Yes, I find it fascinating that she was able to get along with the white legislators. And they accepted her. Mm-hmm. They respected her to the point that when she was elected to the U.S. Congress, they made her governor for a day, which was astounding.
Right.
So the governor and the lieutenant governor leave, and she becomes president pro tem of the Senate, and she gets to be governor for a day. She gets to sign a few bills, and there's lots of speeches and everything, but essentially she is the governor of the state. And that was totally astounding to me. That was in 1973, I believe, which is, you know, it's almost mind-boggling.
Yeah.
The other thing that I find really interesting is that when she came to the U.S. Congress, she enjoyed that same level of respect mm-hmm. and cooperation, not only from the Democratic congressman, but also from the Republican congressman. And that is really mind-boggling to me. The committees that she was on, the times when she would get up to speak, people would be quiet to hear what Barbara had to say. There were certain instances when things would come up and these senators would go to her and, "What do you think about it, Barbara?" And she would answer and they would actually listen to her. How far we've fallen.
Right. 40 years later,
yes,
we see women, of white women and black women, in the Senate and in the House being repeatedly talked over and put down and ignored when they have some of the brightest ideas that our government
has. Oh, and it's not just in the House. It's in general. If anybody remembered Cam Newton's comments this past weekend, just absolutely no respect at all. And I think that part of that is our present administration, which has kind of given them the idea that you really don't have to respect anybody anymore.
It's unearthed a level of disrespect and sexism and racism that's been always there, but
smoldering.
This level, yes, hibernating.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Well, I'm thinking of one thing. There used to be a sign on a door at our old location: if you aren't outraged, you aren't paying attention.
It's true.
And at KKFI, we share a lot of our outrage. And this is our fall fund drive. And that phone number for you to call is 888-931-0901 to make your donation to keep this kind of programming on the air and to keep a voice out there that is able to express the voice of people that are very little heard from in our national media. We don't hear the ideas expressed about, well, we do more so now. It is amazing how many. It is amazing. I think when Trump dissed the media, he really made a mistake, stepped on his toes, because the media does seem to be more willing to talk about his faux pas. But nevertheless,
somebody
I digress.
Needs to.
We
yes.
get back to KKFI, and the fact that we you know, you out there could call us with an idea, and we might invite you to be on the air to talk and share. We are open like that. It's like to have Barbara on the show. I was contacted to have Barbara. I'm so sorry. Barbara Jordan sitting here beside me. Yeah. I was contacted by Evelyn Maddox, wasn't it? Yes. Of the League. And she told me about this event that they were hosting to raise money to help the voter suppression, to work against voter suppression, yes. And the ID, voter ID, that is going to disenfranchise so many people. And so that play is going to be October
the 12th, 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock at the Community Christian Church, right. At 4601 Main Street.
I just tell people it's the one with the big light steeple.
Yes, the light steeple. The Frank Lloyd Wright Church. Mm-hmm. You can park in the parking lot. There's a parking lot off of Cleaver Boulevard. There's an office building there. That parking lot's available. There's parking on the street. Enter from the Main Street entrance or the entrance off of I don't know what street, 46th Street, I guess.
Yes. Mm.
So two entrances that you can gain access to, and for tickets you can go to
The League of Women Voters website. It's lwvkc.org. It's lwvkc.org.
And tickets will be available at the door.
Ah, at the door, too.
Yes.
So great. So how much time do we have left? We have a few minutes left.
Yes. When they are ready to start the broadcast over from UMKC's law school, they'll give us a high sign, and then I'll let you know, and then we can just pot up.
So we can
what's
just
going
continue
on.
Talking
keep
here.
Keep it going. Yeah.
And thanking Jacqueline Gafford of In Play Theater Company. Mm-hmm. And you perform at the Off-Broadway
Theater. Yes, we usually perform at the Just Off-Broadway Theater.
Yeah.
About a month ago, we finished a production there called Grapes Vine. It was very successful. So we're done, basically, for the year at Just Off-Broadway. But I do have another script called Dark Was Their Journey. And that one is going to be done at the community at Westport Center for the Performing Arts. That's at the Westport Presbyterian Church. And Dark Was Their Journey is a story of the three widows, Coretta Scott King, Merle Evers, and Betty Shabazz. Really have to get my mouth around those names. Most people don't realize how hard these women worked to keep their husbands' legacies alive, and that these women were very good friends, and they would take vacations together so that they could be themselves with just the three of them, because they belonged to a unique club that no one else could be in. Their children were friends, and this play will be performed at the church there at, what's the name of that church? Westport Presbyterian Church. It's just around the corner over here. So,
and when does that play start?
That one is going to be October the 24th, I believe.
How long will it run?
That one's, we're only going to do two.
Oh, just two.
Yeah, because okay. It is a stage reading.
Ah.
So if you want to find out more information about it, you can just call the church, and they can give you all the pertinent information. I'm not producing that one. I'm simply directing it, and I'm the playwright. But if you want to call Westport Presbyterian, they'll be able to give you all the particulars about that one.
Now, do you have a website for your...
No, I don't, and I need to, don't I?
Well... Mm-hmm. You might consider that, yeah.
Yes, I definitely should.
How many times have you been asked that question?
Too many times, and that's why I say I really need to do something about it. When I realized the number of plays that I've written had really started to pile up, I had no idea. I really started doing it because my company is very poor and we couldn't afford royalties. So I started writing plays.
Oh, how clever.
Right, so I had a kind of a stable of plays that I've written. Nothing Comes to Sleepers, about the day that Martin Luther King was killed. Harlem Nights, which is about the Harlem Renaissance. I really just did those because we couldn't afford to pay royalties for plays. But over the years, I've really kind of got quite a few plays now. Yeah. So I think probably I should create a website and kind of offer them up for people.
Yes, absolutely. And then you could collect royalties.
Yes, I definitely would.
Yes, that might be a good idea. So we're just kind of hanging out here waiting for the broadcast of Cornell West. I'm not sure what the occasion is. And if Donna, I don't know if Donna can tell us a little bit about Cornell.
Well, it is organized by the Jackson County Bar Association. Cornell West is a nationally known activist and educator and author, teaches at Yale Law School or Harvard Law School. I wish I'd known you were going to say that. I would have pulled up my notes.
So sorry.
Yeah. Why don't we just take a break right now and see if we can just use this time maybe to get things connected over there.
And we'll thank Jackie Gafford one more time, The Life and Times of Barbara Jordan.
And that's October 12th at 7 p.m.
Thank you.
90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, Every Woman, with your host and producer, Sharon Lockhart. I'm Donna Wolf here in the studio. And this is a pretty special broadcast of Urban Connection, of Every Woman. You see, I'm on autopilot. Every Woman and Urban Connections doing a collaborative effort, which is one of the hallmarks, I think, of the Saturday afternoon programming, public affairs programming here at KKFI. We have, on several occasions, worked together, merged our hours that we are allotted for programming because we share common goals. This is Every Woman is Human. Urban Connections connects humans, and we don't recognize these boundaries that some people sort of live their lives by, these boundaries of race and gender and culture and national origin and all of that. So we are bringing you broadcasting from our hearts on the human level because we're all connected, and We need to recognize that. There seems to be such a push now for divisiveness in our society. It's just not cool, and it's causing people to get hurt. Go ahead. Did you want to say something? Okay. Well, Sharon asked me to say a little bit about Cornell West. Dr. Cornell West is going to be answering questions and speaking about his work in a Q&A session over at UMKC School of Law this afternoon, starting sometime around now, in the next few minutes. The event is sponsored by the Jackson County Bar Association, and Every Woman and Urban Connections are participating in this by broadcasting it live so that we can amplify Dr. West's voice, and not just the people who will be gathered in that small mock courtroom will be able to hear his speech and his thoughts, but our wider listening community. Cornell West is a provocative, sometimes thought provocative, and democratic intellectual. He's professor of the practice of public philosophy at Harvard University and holds the title of professor emeritus at Princeton University. He has also taught at Union Theological Seminary, Yale, Harvard, and the University of Paris. Cornell West graduated magna cum laude from Harvard in 3 years and obtained his MA and PhD in philosophy at Princeton. He has written 20 books and has edited 13. He is best known for his classics, including Race Matters and Democracy Matters, and for his memoir, Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. His most recent book, Black Prophetic Fire, offers an unflinching look at 19th and 20th century African American leaders and their visionary legacies. You might have seen him on, like, Bill Maher, the Bill Maher Show on CNN and C-SPAN, and on Democracy Now!, which is broadcast here on KKFI 5 days a week. He made his film debut in The Matrix and was the commentator with Ken Wilber on the official trilogy released in 2004. He's appeared in over 25 documentaries and films, including Examined Life, Call and Response, Sidewalk, and Stand. He's produced 3 spoken word albums, including Never Forget, collaborating with Prince, Jill Scott, Andre 3000, Talib Kweli, and KRS-One, and the late Gerald Levert. His spoken word interludes are featured on productions by Terrence Blanchard, The Cornel West Theory, Raheem Devon, and Bootsy Collins. Dr. West has a passion to communicate to the vast variety of publics in order to keep alive the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a legacy, he says, of telling the truth and bearing witness to love and justice. Love and justice. So that's what we have to look forward to in our engagement. He's here. He's starting. I'm getting the word. We are going to pot up the sound on that and see what we get.
Counts for that leadership. Look forward
there he is.
To the event tonight. 90 years in America, fighting for justice, fighting against vicious legacies of not just white supremacy, but of male supremacy, losing sight of humanity of anybody in a society that tends so often to overlook the least of these. So I salute 90 years of struggle, and I'm glad to be one small voice in that caravan.
Yes, sir. So, Dr. West, Brother West, I want to start with this question, and it's the idea of America, the possibility of America. One of the things that we are hearing more and more is this idea that things are more divisive than most people can remember. Some will say it's the most divisive ever. I would argue that we've simply pulled the covers and shown what's under the bed. It's always been there. These are issues we're reckoning with. But as we think about America and the possibility of America and this idea of working to create and inhabit that nation that we dream of, can you talk to us about what you see the steps being? I mean, I wouldn't dare to ask you for a roadmap,
but
perhaps you can offer us a compass of where we should be going as we dream of this America and the possibility of America.
Thank you for the question. I think I would begin with wonderful line in the great W.B. Du Bois's second autobiography, Dust at Dawn, when he says America suffers from a fear of being truthful about itself, and it therefore is willing to use lies as a method of human uplift. And you can only go so far based on mendacity. And usually mendacity has an intimate relation with criminality. See, the lies viewed as the normal order of things is a way of hiding the crimes that are viewed as the natural order of things. So America's always had a deep tendency to normalize mendacity and naturalize criminality. So if you really talk about the idea of America, you can't talk about that unless you talk about indigenous peoples, their land, their babies, their people, disappear. Well, they don't disappear. You see, they're killed, they're violated, they're subjugated, they dominated, they hated, they despised, they dishonored. That's why a lot of times you hear on television, slavery was America's original sin. That's a lie. It was indigenous peoples first. White supremacy moves fast. But the second one was the enslavement of Africans. You got to tell the truth. And the question then becomes, well, you can only go so far based on lies and crimes because chickens come home to roost. You're going to reap what you sow. Sooner or later, what you repress is going to return. And we saw that in the Civil War. We saw it in the 1960s, and we're seeing it again. We're seeing it now in a very vicious right-wing neo-fascist form, but not just Donald Trump, but with the people behind Trump. The neo-Nazis and the Klan and others feeling very much emboldened and in power with the atavistic, chauvinistic elites that Trump and the others represent right now in the history of the American empire and the history of the American democratic experiment. So fundamentally, we just have to be truthful. Now, what has been crucial about the black freedom struggle is the black freedom struggle has been the major leaven in the American democratic loaf. What I mean by that is that the Frederick Douglasses, Ida B. Wells Barnetts, J. Philip Randolphs, Martin King, Ella Baker, Fannie Lou Hamer, the movements that they represent, they have been the leaven that has allowed the American democratic loaf to both remain fresh and expand. When the black freedom movement is weak, the loaf gets stale. When the truth-telling gets weak, the lies become more predominant. Now, mendacity and criminality are opposed primarily by two things. By love. You wouldn't have the Jackson County Law or Bar Association unless you had lawyers who still love black people enough to tell the truth about white supremacy. If you get lawyers obsessed with success rather than greatness, and love is great and success is money, then, lo and behold, you're not going to have strong enough voices bringing power and pressure to bear. Mm-hmm. So when you say Charles Houston Hamilton, you're not just talking about a brilliant lawyer. You're talking about somebody that's willing to live and die for black people, mm-hmm. live and die for justice. Thurgood Marshall the same way. They're going to the jaws of Jim Crow as lawyers. That's a serious thing, because usually when you're a lawyer, professional, managerial class, you're not talking about life or death no more. You're talking about which suburb you're going to choose from to live in. See, so these are serious folks. Charles Howard Sr., one of the founders of the National Bar Association up in Iowa. We were talking about the relationship between that national organization, Black Lawyers, and Jackson County, who was a lawyer for Paul Robeson, who was a lawyer for W.B. Du Bois. He was disbarred and became the leading journalist of his day as a lawyer. That's the kind of spirit we're talking about if we're going to be able to deal with the forms of mendacity, the forms of criminality that are now presently confronting us. And I say this especially for young people, because young people have been taught in the last 40 years that life is fundamentally about success and being the smartest person in the room. And that's spiritually hollow and empty.
Especially with how we're defining success, right?
That's it, and defining smartness.
Right, right.
Definitely. Du Bois has a wonderful line in Souls of Black Folk when he says black people historically have been one of the few, the kind of oasis in a dusty desert of smartness and dollars. What happens when they're seduced by smartness and dollars in such a way that they lose sight of what is truthful, righteous, sacrificial, service to the least of these? That's a spiritual and moral issue. It's just not political.
We're going to pause right here for a break. We'll be right back with Dr. Cornell West.
Support for KKFI comes from Midwest Music Foundation, presenting the inaugural Goatoberfest Golf Tournament on October the 8th at Adams Point Golf Club in Blue Springs, Missouri, a fundraiser for Gumpy's Foundation, providing families with resources for the holidays, and the Midwest Music Foundation, serving the area's music community with health care assistance, education, career development, and emergency resources. Goatoberfest Golf Tournament on October the 8th at Adams Point Golf Club. All information is at Goatoberfest.com. That's Goatoberfest.com.
This is Sharon Lockhart. We are bringing you Dr. Cornell West live from the UMKC Law School, and this is sponsored by the Jackson County Bar Association, and this is the kind of programming KKFI is able to bring you because we are non-commercial, non-corporate, but we need your support and your dollars. So call 888-931-0901. That's 888-931-0901 to make your pledge to keep this kind of programming independent and radical thought, free thought, on the air at KKFI.
In a beacon of liberty, and yet still talk the world so much about how to love. That's where John Coltrane's Love Supreme comes from. It's true. That's what Marvin Gaye's What's Going On, every note shot through with love. James Baldwin's essays, every sentence, all those commas shot through with love. There's never been a character on the stage of America that had more love than Lorraine Hansberry's mama in A Raisin in the Sun. That genius from the south side of Chicago, she wrote that almost as a teenager. But she comes out of a tradition, a family, a church and mosque and synagogue. We got black Jews, we got black Muslims, we got black Christians and agnostics like James Baldwin. But it was a people who mustered enough courage to love themselves, to respect themselves, to tell the truth about themselves, America, and the world, and then dished it out to the world. Now, we here in Kansas City, I could just say Bird and shut up. I could just say Charlie Parker and shut up. 34 years old, he's gone. They said his body was like that of a 65-year-old because he gave himself unbelievably, mastered his craft, practiced for 15 hours for 4 years, and still was a drug addict. But he taught the world so much about love, excellence, service to others, so that a Coltrane could listen to him as a teenager and say, I want to be like that. I want to be like him. I want that excellence. I want that love. I want that service, sense of service. I want that sense of justice. And I want to be cool and hip, too. And it wasn't just Train. It was Mary Lou Williams. We can go on and on. I got to settle down with all these. I'll make sure the answer's not too long. Because
So let's talk about something here. You talked about the mendacity and the criminality, and you talked about the lies. You talked about our unwillingness to speak truth. And then you talked about our current administration and white supremacy and all those things, not just white supremacy, you talked about male supremacy,
that's
fueling this movement. And yet at the same time, we have these scholars who are trying to tell us that November 8, 2016, was not about race. It was about the middle class, not the middle class, the working class, and what they really mean is the white working class, because they're not referring to working class of color.
That's right.
But that the working class have been abandoned by the liberals. So how do we then take this conversation? Because it seems to me the possibility of America is impossible on our own, right? We have to go beyond to the majority and get them on board. So what is the conversation? What is the narrative that we take to those, presumably, who white supremacy was not the driving force?
Mm-hmm.
Let's just take that hypothetically.
Yes, yes, and that's a crucial question because it sits at the center of so much of the dialogue these days.
Mm-hmm.
And my dear brother Coach, Ta-Nehisi Coates, he's a brilliant journalist and a very good writer in many ways. He's been presenting this view as if it's fundamentally about race, almost all about race. And there's no doubt that white supremacy is very much at the center of it. But you can never understand white supremacy unless you understand empire. That's why I started with indigenous peoples. You see, there's been six wars going on simultaneously for the last 8 years under Obama. Dropped 26,155 bombs in 2016. Drone strikes, Somalia, Pakistan, Afghanistan. For every dollar in the U.S. budget, 53 cents goes to the military-industrial complex for imperial projects. So you're only dealing with 47 cents even when you get to the domestic dialogue, you see. So that the white supremacy that we talk about cannot be just confined to the domestic dynamics. Du Bois taught us. C.L.R. James taught us. James Baldwin taught us. We are a nation among nations in the world. And when you have 4,855 military bases around the world in 42 countries with 150 countries having U.S. special operations, that's an empire. And we're experiencing the decline and the decay of the empire because you got military overreach. Then you've got massive corruption of your elites with Wall Street and big business and big corporations. We know how many Wall Street executives went to jail after massive crimes committed in 2008, insider trading, market manipulation, predatory lending, fraudulent activity. Not one went to jail. But let Jamal and the teacher get caught with a crack bag. Straight to jail. So that you can never talk about just race in and of white supremacy in and of itself. You got to talk about empire, then you got to talk about class. And you especially got to talk about gender. 52% of the humankind are women. So it's not like you're doing them a favor by including them in your analysis. They're not a minority. Patriarchy is real. It kills people. You see, in black communities, brown communities, white communities, and so forth. So this idea of race as an abstraction that's not intimately connected to empire, predatory capitalism, grotesque wealth inequality, 1% of the population, only 42% of the wealth. That's a class question. And then we got homophobia and transphobia. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about black people, you're talking about James Baldwin. He's a gay brother. You're talking about Audre Lorde. She's a lesbian sister. You're talking about trans folk. You see? And it's not PC chit-chat. You're trying to be truthful. The condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak. That's everybody's suffering. That's not just one slice of humanity's suffering. That's everybody. You have to be international. And some people say we ought to include the dogs and the donkeys and things in terms of animals' rights. Well, that's a different dialogue. I can be open to that. That's fine. That's fine. But I want Letitia and Jamal included.
Right.
And I want to start on the chocolate side of town. And the reason why I start, I have a bias. My mama's black. And my grandfather's black. But that doesn't mean I love others less. But usually when people talk in universal terms, they don't include black people. They don't include brown. They don't include red. You see? So you've got to be explicit in terms of starting on the chocolate side of things. And then allowing the love and the justice to spill over to vanilla and other sides, you see? So in that sense, when we're really talking about the election, mm-hmm. we're really talking about the ways in which the American empire was in deep crisis. And the response was you had two political parties. You had a right-wing party that was undergoing deep crisis, and the billionaire leapfrogged over the establishment and the Republican Party, surprised them and everybody else. Then you had a Democratic Party, also in deep crisis, thinking that all they had to do was to trot out the same kind of neoliberal white candidate, and somehow she was going to beat this manipulative, entertaining gangster. And that's what Donald Trump is. He's a gangster. I said, oh, Brother West, that's hard. No, that's not hard at all. A gangster is not a subjective expression. It's an objective condition. When you're grabbing women's private parts without their permission, that's gangster. When you're stealing somebody else's oil without their permission, that's gangster. That's an objective condition. Trump has been doing that for over 45 years. How did a right-wing gangster tied to white supremacy, tied to expansion of empire, misogynist to the core, homophobic, win the election? That's the question.
That is the question.
That is the question. And it's a combination of deeply white supremacist sensibilities being mobilized, of grotesque wealth inequality, with people feeling completely helpless, completely impotent, completely unable to exert any kind of power. And that was working class, which is multiracial. Mm-hmm. Across the board. Mm-hmm. And it was also misogynist. The gender question was very important. Very important. You see. And 53% of white sisters voted for the gangster. You know, that's not a salutary fact.
But we can't forget the 94%, though.
The 94%
of
black folk who voted against Trump. You're absolutely right. But then, you know, they voted for Hillary. You say, well, the anti-Trump, I can understand. It's hard to get excited about a neoliberal, pro-Wall Street, pro-imperial figure like Hillary Clinton, who called my young brother super predators in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's the choice we got to make between the gangster and the liar, hey, you know, somebody pass the cognac, you know what I mean? I take Hennessy, you take Cavassier. Very much so. I mean, the sad thing was in the election that for the first time in decades, the most progressive bloc in the Democratic Party refused to go for the most progressive candidate, Bernie Sanders.
What do you think that was about?
Bernie Sanders was not known among black folk. Black folk like to know somebody before they vote for him. He was not that well known.
What could he have done to rectify that?
I think that he could have started earlier in talking about his long history of fighting against white supremacy. But Hillary Clinton also was part of a neoliberal clientage network because they got a lot of money among the black leaders and black preachers and so forth. So they hardly even gave Bernie Sanders a chance to be heard because they already had lined up behind Hillary Clinton. And And that to me is a, that's a deep crisis of black leadership. I know that's another lecture, that's another dialogue. But when it comes to our black leaders, we've got too many of them who just up for sale. Mm. They just up for sale, that's all. We got too many of them.
So let me
ask Not all
you.
Of them, but too many of them really are.
So this question then, you know, that makes me think about 2004.
Yes.
Yeah, before Barack Obama won the Iowa primaries. A lot of our black elite, black leadership was against him and was
Oh, 2008.
Him.
2008.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, 2008. No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I remember sitting in the room with Brother Barack Obama. Who else was in there? It was Eric Holder was in there. Jesse Jackson Jr. was in there. At that time, we had 4% of black America supporting Barack Obama because they didn't think he could win. Now, I told Brother Barack, I see, look, I've been known to make some real bad predictions, but you're going to win this thing, because all we had to do was to leapfrog over the Clinton machine and win. He just was not that well known. And black folk didn't really shift until after Iowa. Mm-hmm. We went down to South Carolina and spent 2.5 weeks every day in South Carolina, and that was a real push, as it were. Mm-hmm. But my argument was, in many ways, the same as it is today, that I thought that the Clinton's neoliberal machine had to be overcome. And by neoliberal, I mean those who see a social problem and their instinct is to privatize, financialize, or militarize. So you get gentrification, privatize healthcare, privatize education, privatize across the board, put a little weight to public things, public health, public schools, so forth and so on. And then bring in big banks. Being financialized, and so we had long talks about Brother Barack and so forth, and we had serious discussions about Wall Street and big corporate power and big business and big money and so forth and so on. And once the turning took place, and it looked as if black folk were going to come home, black folk get a sense of who is this Barack Obama. Oh, I see, we might have a chance. I also saw my brother leaning more and more toward Wall Street, toward the corporate elites, and that's why I had to be consistent and start going at him.
So let's talk about that, Brother West.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, indeed.
Let's talk about
too many
that.
Children poor to be Wall Street friendly. I mean, when Barack had the meeting in March 2009 with the head Wall Street elites, it's a very important meeting. It's in the book called Confidence Man, Ron Suskind. And he told him explicitly, I stand between you and the pitchforks, but I want to let you know I'm on your side. I will protect you. I said, you don't say that to Wall Street elite. You say that to the kids.